The following program is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and was first broadcast in 1984. The world of Islam. Whither Islam? The future of the Islamic resurgence. The program is introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings.
There are two ways of looking at the current Islamic resurgence. Either it is a passing fad, blown out of all proportion by the media and tied to the rise and fall of the price of oil, or it represents something altogether deeper and more permanent, if less spectacular. There are few easy conclusions and only half-answered questions. For instance, is the Islamic revival merely a subtle new form of nationalism in the Islamic world? Or is it part and parcel of a much broader attempt to find solutions to the problems of modernization from within one's own traditions and culture? And how are we supposed to measure the success or failure of this Islamic revival? In terms of institutional change and political rhetoric, or by mosque attendance and religious dress? Is this something that will come to fruition in a handful of years? Or should we be measuring it in terms of generations? Then again, are we too preoccupied with what is happening in the Arab and Iranian worlds, to the exclusion of the experiments in, say, Pakistan or Malaysia? Thus far, it is probably fair to say that the record of achievement has been mixed at best. Nowhere, for example, is there a state that is generally recognized by Muslims as purely Islamic. And while the Sharia, or divine law, has been reintroduced in several countries, too often the emphasis appears to be placed on the hudud, or punishments, such as amputation for theft, rather than on the liberating or merciful nature of Islam. There appears to be an equally excessive preoccupation with prohibitions in social and sexual matters. In the economic field, the alms tax, or zakat, has been largely taken over by the state. While interest-free banks are established in several countries, few Muslim economists even seem ready to believe that they alone can hold the keys to economic growth. Most Muslim thinkers acknowledge they will have to be part of a broader Islamic model that looks as much to the present and future as to Islam's past. Is there, in fact, a danger that in their impatience to Islamize their societies, many Muslim countries may be overemphasizing form at the expense of substance? Another unresolved question is whether Islam contains within itself answers to the problems of the 21st century. Are its principles sufficiently flexible to permit the necessary adaptation? Is the current revival, as some insist, merely a final anguished cry of despair on the part of people who have tasted too often the bitterness of despotism, underdevelopment, and failure? Or does it really signal the Renaissance of beliefs and culture that gave the modern world much of its scientific and cultural glory? And finally, are we in the West perhaps guilty of seeking out the spectacular revolution of the street when the true Islamic revival may be taking place in the quiet of the classroom and home all over the Muslim world? This last program in our series is reported and narrated by Julian Crandall Hollick.
The Muslims as a whole are dissatisfied with and almost increasingly disillusioned with the performance of their own regimes, everywhere, almost without exception.
Kamal Farooqi is a lawyer and writer on Sharia, or Islamic law, now living in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad.
And equally, I think they're equally convinced that the solution lies through an Islamic approach. What that Islamic approach is, that is the great open question.
I would like to see Islam be very relevant to the lives of Muslims today. And I think Islam, if it wants to stay a living religion, must be able to adapt itself to the changing situations and human development in our world.
Indonesian writer Mokhtar Lubis in Jakarta is in no doubt what that approach should be.
I think we must rethink many of the tenets of Islam, which had been applied for a 7th century situation, human situation, or society, And it must be reinterpreted according to the needs of people, of human beings of today and the future.
Magda Lubis's approach is characteristic of many Indonesian Muslims, unencumbered by the weight of Islam's history. But in the Arab and Asian heartland of the Islamic world, this straightforward approach to the modernization of Islamic thought and institutions has to contend with the political manipulation of Islam by politicians in search of legitimacy.
We have seen that some autocrat rulers are using Islam to get their political end, to get their autocratic rule established in the name of Islam.
Akbar ul Alam lives in the Bangladeshi capital of Dhaka. Like most Bangladeshis, Akbar ul Alam would prefer Islam to be a visible moral force rather than a support for particular regimes. He's particularly concerned at the negative Islam that seems to be introduced in some Muslim countries.
Those rulers, those who are uttering or creating Islam, always and everywhere, everything, within everything, and create terror, not only in the mind of non-Muslim, but also in the mind of Muslims. They have created a situation when our generation or next generation will think that Islam is a religion of terror.
Is the Islamic revival being manipulated by politicians to secure popular approval for their autocratic rule? John Esposito is a young American scholar who has traveled frequently throughout the Muslim world. Esposito thinks co-optation is much more a two-way street.
I think that what's happening is that effective religious leaders who demonstrate that indeed there is broad support for a reappropriation or reaffirmation of one's Islamic heritage then wind up proving to the leadership of a country that this is something that a politically wise person has to take into consideration.
I think that it's going to win more ground. Not because it's better, not because it gives better solution to our problems, but simply because of the very, very low condition of the Islamic people now.
Fuad Zakaria is an Egyptian-born critic of the current Islamic revival, now living in Kuwait. Zakaria simply doesn't believe that there can be a real renewal of Islamic thought and practice in the modern world.
It will succeed temporarily, but in the long run, it will be exposed. But you have to, it seems that we have to go through the experience itself in order to learn the lesson. It seems so. You have to go through it, you have to try it, and you have to see the failure with your own eyes. And this is what's going to happen. It will reach the summit of its success, and then it will be exposed.
I don't think you can run a society around a country, not even in a country where Muslims are the vast majority, just on hopping on labels and slogans. You have to have concrete programs, what you want.
Anwar Ibrahim, one of the founders of the powerful Muslim youth movement of Malaysia, is now a member of the Malaysian government. Anwar believes Islam can only play a full role in society if it's able to break free from the dogmatism that has suffocated Islamic thought since the 14th century. The process of creative or independent thought is known as ijtihad and has been advocated by Muslim revivalists throughout the centuries to counter blind obedience to past dogmas.
There's no Islamic revivalism without the process of tajdid or ijtihad or renewal of thought.
It has to evolve a divergent strategy to recast, remold its laws in accordance with the modern needs. This is the one, I think, this is the job that has to be done.
Like Anwar Ibrahim, Mohammed Saeed, editor of the small Islamic World Times, published in a leafy suburb of Islamabad, believes that Islam must be subjected to ijtihad if it's to be made relevant to today's problems.
Fundamentals were there. They are immutable. They are not to be changed. Nevertheless, in details, in the applicability of certain things and formula. One has to exercise one's brain to the utmost. And that has to be done by the jurists, by the scholars of the modern times.
The great debate centers on the degree of reinterpretation believed permissible. Some activists are inclined to take a literalist stand. The modernists agree that the fundamentals are immutable, but would be far more willing to seek methods or techniques consistent with those principles from outside Islam if necessary.
We believe that we have to live in our age. We have to modernize the Islamic thinking and to utilize it in reforming our society, in giving motivation to our people, in safeguarding our heritage and our traditions.
Kamal Asharif is a former member of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt and now Jordanian minister of Akaf, or religious charities. Under Sharif's reformist direction, Jordan is even considering reinterpreting the Quran.
We are also thinking of having an institution specialized for the new interpretations of the Quran on a modern basis. We are thinking of having this institution, of making use, of course, of the old interpretations, but try to have completely new interpretation of the Quran from the modern experience of our age.
Islamic notion of going back to the past has been misunderstood by the West completely. It is not trying to imitate in the dress and manner and things of the people of Makkah or Medina, rather following the principles of the Quran and Sunnah and applying them for a modern society.
For conservative Muslim activist Anis Ahmed in Islamabad, adaptation means a marriage of past and future. Muslims who claim that true Islam lies in a literal return to the habits and way of life of 7th century Arabia come in for his particular scorn.
If you ask him, do you have a camel tied outside your villa of $25 million, or is it a Mercedes Benz which you are driving with a chauffeur? If he is really keen to go back, then he should have a camel outside and not that Mercedes Benz.
But I think by and large, people are realizing that there are certain modern problems which have to be dealt with. So what they are saying at the moment is that Islam gives certain fundamental concepts. It characterizes a society in a certain way. It has a set of fundamental values, and they have to restructure the whole society in accordance with that set of fundamental values or fundamental principles, not necessarily in the same way as it was modeled 1400 years ago.
Muslim scholar Mansoor Ahmed in the southern Pakistani city of Karachi argues that even conservative Muslims realize that some rethinking is necessary.
So even those fundamentalists, by and large, recognize this fact that they have to take recourse to what they call ijtihad, that they have to assert themselves and they have to find answers to certain questions which are new questions and for which no answers are available in the traditional knowledge.
Unfortunately, the need for rethinking is about all that conservative, traditionalist, and modernist can agree on.
There is no agreement on a definition of Islam as to what Islam is.
Aga Abdul Hamid was cabinet secretary in the Ayub Khan government in the 1960s and has been a regional prime minister in Pakistan. He's a representative of the modernist school of Pakistani Muslims, often referred to as Aligarians.
Of course, you can start by saying anybody who believes in God and his prophet and the Quran is a Muslim. So far, so good. No dispute there. But the point is, after you've said that, there are a million other things about which you have to make decisions. Society these days, in fact in all times, but more so these days, is a very complex affair. And a number of questions have to be answered. And when those questions crop up, then there are differences. And one of the reasons why more has not been achieved is that these differences so far have not been resolved. It's very easy to take up a fundamentalist line because that's popular, particularly with the villagers and with the uneducated, and you're on very safe ground. But then it means that you're not really answering the questions which society is faced with.
In much of the Arab world and in Pakistan, Muslim activists seem determined to follow an abstract blueprint which they believe can be applied in any situation. In other parts of the Islamic world, Muslims appear to be rather more pragmatic. Khalija Saleh is a physicist and Muslim activist in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
You have grapefruits, you have oranges, you have lime. Are they the same? Are they different? You can see there is something common in there, but at the same time, they are different. So in the light of this, there are principles in Islam that everyone should adhere to. The form, that can vary depending on the geographical situation, economic situation, the cultural aspect of the society itself. I think with that analogy, we can appreciate the fact that Muslims do share some common values while at the same time maintaining their own identity.
Harun Nasution and Dawan Rahadjo in Jakarta claim that Islam in Indonesia is more forward-looking than its Arabian or Iranian counterparts because it's unencumbered by the past.
Those countries have their glorious past, Islamic past, and we don't have our Islamic past. We never go to the past when we talk about Islam. We look for the future.
It's impossible to have Islam in the form like they have in the past. It's impossible. It's ridiculous.
Dawan Rahadjo is a former leader of the Indonesian Muslim Students Association, known as HMI, and he's now editor of the influential weekly, Tempo.
Of course, Muhammad is our prophet. He's a great, he's just our prophet. He bring a new value and transform the society from bad society into good society, but it's only applied to that day. You know, we have to have new historical interpretation of the Muhammad life and transform into our practical life now.
Law, of course, plays an essential part in Islam. Many critics of the resurgence believe the Sharia or Islamic law is too inflexible to be applicable in the 20th century. Many modernists, however, believe the Sharia is sufficiently flexible and can be modernized. Anwar Ibrahim in Malaysia not only wants a modernization of the Sharia, he argues that Muslim society should also be prepared to assimilate Western and other law where the latter are consonant with Islam.
What we need in this country is, of course, an appraisal, a call towards some sort of legal reform that could use the principles of the Sharia law and apply still some aspects of Western law wherever it is applicable. Some of us feel that we would like to see the application of the Sharia law, but we must accept the fact that in terms of application, many aspects of the Western secular law is still much better than the application of the Sharia laws.
Harun Nasution in Jakarta is equally firm in his conviction that the Sharia must be entirely reinterpreted.
The Islamic law that are derived or that were derived from the Quran 1,000 years ago, most of them are not practical in these days. So when you speak about Islamic law, I think we have to make a new Islamic law that will fit this modern life. And for that, we have to go to the principles as they are laid down in the Quran. So, for example, cutting the hand is no longer suitable to our days. Or as they do in Pakistan, what do you call it?
Flogging.
Yeah, flogging is no longer suitable for our days.
We have got to go back to the origins. This is another of the necessary changes I am talking about.
Sadiqa Mahdi is a leading activist in the Sudan. The great-grandson of the Mahdi, or Messiah, whose troops took Khartoum from General Gordon in the 1880s, Sadiq al-Mahdi is the leader of the powerful Ansar movement, a former prime minister, and now a thorn in the side of the present government.
We go back to the origins and codify Sharia in a new light without abiding with any of those schools of law. We may use the material they used, we may use the methods they used, but not at all abide ourselves by them.
But will these forces of modernization be given time to experiment, or will public impatience for immediate solutions and the weight of conservatism stifle this new intellectual flowering at birth?
You've come to a position there where the traditional interpretation of the Islamic sources of the Quran and Sunnah is showing its limitations to put the matter at its mildest. And that somewhere along the line, one of two things is likely to occur. One is that people, the traditionalists will say, the reason for the failure, the reason for the non-working of the system is we haven't been genuine enough. Why aren't all members of the government wearing a beard? Why is it not that the courts are entirely composed of the clergy? Why is it not that the clergy are the sole administrators? Then alone can you implement these laws. So there would be a drift toward an even more extreme form of conservatism.
John Esposito agrees that this short-term danger is very real, but feels that a renewal of thought and action is very much possible. Esposito also believes that too much attention in the West has been placed on those small groups advocating change through revolution.
For the vast majority of Muslims, the process of Islamization of society is one of peaceful social transformation. That individuals become more Islamically observant, that to that extent then the society becomes more Islamically observant. Then one has pressure to introduce more Islamic laws. Having brought about a more Islamic society, one can say that the government is more Islamically oriented. It's only a small fraction of Muslims in the world that then become members of, let's say, radical groups that advocate a violent overthrow of governments through terrorist means.
For most modernists, Islamization will not come about through overnight imposition of the Sharia, the Hadad punishments, dress codes, and sexual segregation, but through education and a gradual raising of Muslims' understanding of their faith over several generations. Khurshid Ahmad is a leader of the Jamaat-e-Islami party in Pakistan and a leading Islamic activist who served in the first government of President Zia-ul-Haq that introduced Islamization measures. Khurshid feels that a concerted evolutionary approach is the only possible way.
If just in one particular part something is done and there is no corresponding change in other parts, then we are heading towards trouble. So although it has to be a gradual evolutionary approach, a phased approach, but it is an all-embracing approach, each sector somehow is strengthening the process. And we lay the foundations on information and education, not on compulsion and law, although law is an integral part of the total package.
An Islamic institution cannot be constructed without an Islamic consciousness. That consciousness can come about through education. Without education, that consciousness will not be able to have a strong foundation, and whatever institution you're going to build on that is going to have very, very shallow foundation.
Kamal Hassan is an Islamic activist in Malaysia who agrees that Islamization is essentially an educational process.
Because Islam is something that cannot be imposed and must not be imposed. Islam cannot impose its will upon others unless they willingly desire that change in their hearts and in their minds. So that must come through education and not through imposition of one's will.
We don't want to superimpose Islam through law over a hypocritic, reluctant society, because this would not represent a religious project
Hassan Atarabi is leader of the Muslim Brothers in the Sudan and a former attorney general. For the past few years, Dr. Tarabi has been in charge of the Islamization of the legal system in that country.
We are infiltrating society and acting through society so that ultimately you produce a new civilization, in fact, a new attitude to sports, to music, to knowledge, to the family, to neighborhood, to economic enterprise, to all aspects of life and to politics, ultimately.
This type of evolutionary change will not occur overnight, but will probably only bear fruit a generation from now. Musa Kailani lives in Amman, Jordan.
I foresee things in the future, that there will be more assertion of Islamic identity when those people, those young generations in the age of 12 or 13 or 14, when they are 35 or 40 or 45, they will be the ones to reshape things along the blueprints of Islamic identity.
The current resurgence, therefore, may not be a last cry of anger or frustration, but the expression and vehicle for a highly compressed process of modernization. The passage from a feudal to a modern society took the West several hundred years and included the French and Russian revolutions. It's perhaps inevitable that the Islamic revival will know its share of violence and conflict.
What we have to get over is that during the last 600-700 years, very little of ijtihad was done. And Islamic law that developed in the mosques was really like development in cloisters. It was not the ruling law of the day. A certain amount of area, a good 600-700 years of ijtihad will have to be done, compressed into a time factor of, say, 50-60 years. And this is a very difficult exercise because taking to something that is new is not always easy.
Khalid Isaac is a former member of the Islamic Ideology Council, now living in Karachi.
It is at a stage where it sounds very much like many voices being spoken at the same time and not, things not being very clear. But you know, these intense debates always accompany major efforts to make a breakthrough. And my own feeling is that something substantial will come out of it. The mood is noisy, but I think basically self-confident.
Whither Islam was written and produced by Julian Crandall Hollick. The program was introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings. The technical producer was Peter K. Storkerson, and the rebroadcast producer was Dean Capello. The music consultant was Brian Silver of International Music Associates. Consultants to this program were Professors John Esposito of Holy Cross College, John Vole of the University of New Hampshire, and the late Richard Mitchell of the University of Michigan. The World of Islam is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, in cooperation with WBUR Boston, and is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Mark Schilling. If you'd like to comment on this program or to order cassette copies and transcripts, please phone area code 508-486-9180 or fax number 508-486-9652 during regular business hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.